If you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Guido Giacomo Preparata. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
That's good.
Okay. Guido Giacomo Preparata. He is an assistant professor of political economy at the University of Washington, born in Boston, Massachusetts, raised in the USA, France, and Italy. He completed his PhD in political economy and economics history at the University of Southern California in 1998. He is an author, an essayist, a blogger. His website is guidopreparata.com. He is the author of several books, including The Ideology of Tyranny and Conjuring Hitler. Conjuring Hitler is a book that we'll be talking about today. A fascinating analysis of the events that led to the rise of the Third Reich and the Second World War. In this book, here's the abstract of the book that he provides. In the first 50 years of the 20th century, witnessed Britain's determination to annihilate the threat of German hegemony on the continental landmass. The British Empire feared that a possible merger of the German Reich with the Russian Tsarist Empire might have given birth to a much-dreaded Eurasian alliance. A fastness in the heart of Eurasia would have attracted in its orbit men, resources, and geographical advantages in such numbers that it would have threatened and eventually foiled British imperial domination across the world. To prevent such an alliance, Britain embarked upon an extraordinary feat of aggression, which began with the Great War, 1914-1918. This act followed up by the 15-year-long incubation of Hitlerism, which Britain would eventually need to set up Germany in the view of a second two-front world conflict that would have sanctioned the erasure of German rivalry once and for all. Okay. That's a synopsis of your book, an excellent synopsis. So this is a challenge to the official narrative, the moralistic tale we've been given to the Second World War and perhaps the entire 20th century, the world that depends on British and also American enlightenment to protect and extend freedom and civilization, extend civilization to the rest of the globe. So, hey, how do you want to get into this? What's the best way to get into this topic?
Well, yes, I guess it's the greatest militant myth of our epoch, and how I got into it originally was not to challenge anything. I was working at the Central Bank of Italy I was in my 20s I decided to do something, sort of research a topic that would be fancy, and I decided to look into Nazi finance. And then that prompted a variety of questions, and I decided to investigate the whole story. And that's how the book began. And I was, as I was reading a variety of other sources on this story, and it didn't start as a desire to challenge anything, but more of just going to more depth into some of these fancier, more esoteric themes, such as, for instance, as I said, what allowed the Germany to get out of depression and in the 30s and achieve what was then defined as an economic miracle. So that's how it started.
So now in the book, you begin with the dawn of the 20th century and the realization among the British elite, the Anglosphere, that their global pretensions, their pretensions of global control, or the desire for global control, or protecting what they perceived to be their global control at the time, the British Empire, was being threatened by this new nation state on the scene that had, I guess, developed out of the Franco-Prussian War in the 1870s.
Yes.
But it had been developing throughout the 19th century. German, you know, concentration, the sort of unification of the Germanic states, I would think, triggered by the Napoleonic Wars, ironically. You know, so they realize around 1900 that there's this German nation state that's coming on like gangbusters. So the British elite start to strategize against this continental power, correct?
Yes. Well, I mean, okay, to go back to your first question, I guess we all were, I mean, as I grew up as an Italian, very much in the new American peace. So in a family that was profoundly anti-communist and very pro-US and so on and so forth. And so we received this whole story where, of course, as you said, you know, there's democracy, there's the new world, this new world order, and that was just built upon the defeat of this demoniacal German episode. Well, there's no question here, and there's no desire of taking away the fact that it was indeed a monstrous manifestation. But the question I always began to ask myself was, as I wrote in the book, a very cinematographic one. I mean, Nazism always made for great cinema because you had these, you know, on screen, you had these sons of bitches in these beautifully cut uniforms that just came on and started doing all sorts of monstrous things. And it's just, and so you start asking yourself, you know, how did this happen? Where did they come from? How did we manage, especially out of Germany, which at the time, at the 20th century, was, in terms of the arts and sciences, was just the top there was in the West. It was far superior to anything offered in the Anglo-American sphere, in every department of the arts and sciences. And yet, out of this allegedly super sophisticated spiritual creature comes out this monstrosity, which is then unleashed or just wreaks havocs upon the world and is then defeated. And so on. This is why I was talking about a militant myth. So I wanted to know, how did this happen? And as you start to dig in this story, you just realize that it's, you know, you go into what's called, all people who've read history know this, it's called the interwar period. And it's devilishly complicated and very frustrating as a topic, because the books are either extremely dissatisfying or they go into such detail that they become just tedious, and so you know it, there's no real narrative, and you read more and more to these books about what happened in the 30s, and it was all like, you know, the usual explanation. It's a collection of blunders. There was this, there was that, and then they made a mistake. They were too harsh in treating the Germans in Versailles and so on. And out of this resentment, the movement of revanchism comes out, and then all sorts of people miscalculated, and it turned into a giant blunder, a giant mistake, which snowballed and became this atrocity. And I always find these explanations completely dissatisfying. So yes, in terms of the geopolitical understanding of the world, it's pretty basic. we are now, this is the cosmic time of the British and of, you know, this is their, it has been the end, their empire last century, and the United States are continuing it in the 20th. And now it seems that we're going through a second edition of the Cold War. And we might discuss this as we go on. It's just the way it is. These powers, and this is just in terms of pure geostrategic terms, has nothing to do about its people or anything. Just if you reason in terms of violence and power and domination, which is most people do, unfortunately, and teach others to do, the reasoning is this. England and America are islands, and if they want to control the world, they have to make sure that whatever is out there left, which is not them, which is the Eurasian landmass, has to be perennially divided. And or else, if there is a coagulation, if there's a concentration of national and cultural interest in the Eurasian landmass, it's for them, in terms of power and domination, over. And concretely, this the British just laid out these considerations in very plain terms. They said, what is going to happen if Germany, which is this powerhouse, this emerging powerhouse, it is not just a powerhouse, it is something that it's a people with extraordinary know-how. What if they harness to this know-how the immense powers, resources of and history of Russia? What happens if they're going to harness this to their project? Well, they just made a few computations, and they said if that happens, it's the end of the game. They will be too strong, they will aggregate too much power, and it will never be possible for us to control anything, not the seas, not the coast, not anything. So therefore, we have to preempt that, we have to prevent that, and we're going to draw wedges along the landmass. We're going to debilitate this potential Eurasian threat in any way possible. This was, so it's a plan of aggression. It is. So forget about talks of love and human rights and democracy. This is a game of power. This is a game of violence. And this is the only logic that seems to be acceptable to mankind at this time, certainly for the elites and for those who depend on them. So this is how they reason. So the British Empire reasoned in these terms, and what they had achieved was already extraordinary. We're just a small country with a very sophisticated navy, dominated the world and had the Raj of India, and all these things awed everybody, including Hitler, of course. And this kind of conception of the world and conception of domination is continued in the vision of the strategist of the United States, which use still the sea, but use also very much air power, you know, controlling the air. And it's just the same thing. And so all these games and all these choreographies that we see with Russia, it's always the same game. Now, Germany has been neutralized, or so appears to be neutralized, but Russia remains this big thing there that has to be managed somehow. But the imperative, the geostrategic imperative, is always that. This is how they reason. So we have islands versus a mass. Hence, the game. Germany, the first 50 years of the 20th century were consummated into making sure that Germany would just disappear and not be a threat anymore. And that's an extraordinary story, which I have tried to fathom. It's extraordinary in every sense. It's extremely complicated. And it would have been best had a bunch of Germans explain to us what happened to them in this story, but it hasn't happened yet. They still go through this period of demonization. We have not understood exactly what possessed the spirit of that country to lead it where it did lead it. But this is what it was in terms of the history of that period. It was just to do away with this threat. And the British have won an unconditional victory over this enemy. They have disposed of it. It took them two world conflicts. So we're talking about, I don't know, 70 million dead to do it, but it was done. And at this point, we are in a completely different kind of scenario. So in a nutshell, this is the story.
Yeah. I'm getting an echo there. Okay.
I'm sorry?
I'm hearing my voice echo. Now it's gone. Okay, that's okay. Okay. So, yeah, I think that's best. Just prior to the First World War, Henry Balfour was being questioned about this very thing. Great Britain's relationship to Germany, and I forget who was asking him, but Henry Balfour said that war was inevitable, and I think his interlocutor said, well, we could just try to work harder. And yeah. The response was, no, I think we should go to war instead.
Right.
They could not compete. So in a sense, we're talking about this British geostrategy, but it's Halford Mackinder, the Mackinder Doctrine. And I think, as you pointed out there, is we are still living with the ghost of Mackinder, because it Mackinder Doctrine informs today's strategy, Anglo-American strategy, with NATO, what's going on in Europe, and even in the Middle East, this process of destabilization, weaponized human rights, these things.
Yeah, for that, for that, it's virtually identical, yes. Mm-hmm.
And that we're not
it's made out.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
In its main outlines, yes. Well, as far as World War I is concerned, you know, this is the idea that Germany was always the aggressor. Okay, here's the story. No doubt, no doubt. I mean, there are some of the most amazing analyses of what Germany was have been written by a Norwegian American, you know, Thorsten Veblen, wrote these extraordinary pieces like Imperial Germany, where he describes exactly in almost in geospiritual terms what they were. This, he called them an unstable compound. Of this income, they have not been able to. They had not been able to merge their artistic side with this martial kind of intoxication that they had. There is no question that Germany wanted war, but it wanted some kind of a in their madness. They wanted in their madness for war. They wanted some kind of fast war to create what they called Mitteleuropa, which was a kind of an enlargement of their area of interest through also the Austrian Empire, and controlling some kind of a central European area, and just dispatch it in 3 months with a few dead in this vision and be done with it. And they were harassing the Brits because, of course, they had a navy and they wanted their place in the sun. They wanted a few colonies. So no question. They were aggressive. They were blustery. They were difficult to deal with. They were very militaristic, and so on and so forth. That part of the story I do not contest in the least. What's much more interesting, though, however, is that they were leading a policy of continuous harassment of their neighbors, and of wanting to assert themselves as this new power. Which, of course, there were others there. There was France, but most importantly, there was Britain. And Britain eventually orchestrated a different kind of war. So they wanted their own little war. They didn't get that. They got Britain's war. They were completely fooled, but they weren't these innocent victims, but they were definitely fooled. And instead of having their war, they got Britain's. In the history books, what we read instead is that Britain and all these other, they had their little ambitions. They had their interests, of course, but they were overall peaceful states. And this German annoyance came, and they had to roll up their sleeve and get rid of it. Well, this reading of history, then I reject completely. No, they were all hell-bent on dominating. And the one who was just more masterful at it, the British, just did what had to be done to get rid of this menace. Orchestrated, just primed Belgium and did all sorts of things and played and financially and militarily, just at the very high levels at which it always has played. And then defeated the Germans. It had to do it in two installments, but defeated the war anyway. So this is key. So, of course, the reading is always biased, because they always make us fear that the British are these classy gentlemen that really didn't want any trouble, didn't want to harm anybody, but eventually had to do what had to be done. No, that's not at all how it went.
And a big part of that plan, of course, was bringing the American cousins into the fight.
Oh, well, they were absolutely essential, yes, because when the Russian front collapsed, because, of course, the Kaiser should have understood that he had this, and they never did. They were opposed to the Russians, which they considered inferiors. I mean, they were, from their own strategic viewpoint, complete imbeciles in that sense. But eventually the Russians collapsed, and then, of course, they brought 2 million Americans, which just, it was the shock that led the Duumvirate, those Ludendorff and Hindenburg, to capitulate. They capitulated, and so the war had been devastating, but Germany had been not defeated on her own soil. And so, and from that moment on, from November 18th until the rise of Hitler, then begins this extraordinary game of chess and this whole story and this incubation of Nazism, which is the sulfurous topic, which is the preparation for the final act, which will to what we know.
And of course, in November 1918, the Germans had sued for peace under the terms offered by Wilson in his 14 points.
Right. Well, eventually, and then Versailles came, and they felt betrayed, and so on and so forth. And I tell that story. I mean, there's, for me, the most important piece of political economy ever written in that I have ever written, but it's Thorsten Veblen again. Is a review of John Maynard Keynes' book on the Peace at Versailles, where he says Keynes hasn't understood anything about what's happening, and the Treaty of Versailles has given you the impression that they're trying to, in a sense, molest or insult the Germans, which is nothing of the sort. They have left the elites untouched because they have not touched their financial wealth. And all what these other reparations are going to do, they're going to affect the middle class. They're going to debilitate the middle class, which is exactly what's going to happen with the hyperinflation. And he uses even the term radicalizing, which is exactly the kind of word that's going to be used in the propaganda of Goebbels and the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to recruit enough forces to create a revanchist movement, which Veblen said is going to be thrust against Soviet Russia, which was... I mean, and this was an absolutely genial prophecy. He wrote this piece in 1920, and it was, and of course, his heart, because he thought that communist Russia was finally, he romanticized what happened there, and thought that Russia had finally brought peace amongst workers. It was not the case, but it was true by half, because yes, the invasion of Russia happened, but the plan was not to invade Russia. The plan was to crush the Germans between two fronts again, and they did.
And it, of course, in the First World War, British intrigue had successfully brought Imperial Russia and Imperial Germany to blows, which was a key part of their strategy, because they feared that Eurasian alliance. And in that war, you got a combination of effective Russian defeat and German defeat, and that was, of course, I guess, fomented by the Anglo-American powers supporting the injection of Bolshevism into Russia, correct?
Yes. Well, the Bolshevik thing is another deep mystery. I mean, I did, this is like enormous, and I try to cover, I mean, as much as I could in writing that book. We're talking about, you know, tens and tens of thousands of pages. Ideally, these kinds of investigations have to be led by teams of experts, and just to understanding all the deep maneuvers that were ongoing in Russia through the British, and we'll see some of the appeasers that were there already, that you'll see them come back in the 30s, were agents in Russia from the British government. Yes, the role of Rasputin. I mean, it's an extraordinary story. So, and of course, and the role of France too. I mean, to keep the bond strong, the links between France and England and Russia, and always separated for Germany. So that was... And of course, the role of the Bolsheviks, extraordinary. And I've looked into the history of the, we've all, and it's a weird story. And people say, well, of course, well, the Germans, of course, had their spies. And just Lenin was just like, you know, he was doing nothing in Zurich, wasting his time. And so finally they took him, they packaged him like a nice little toy, and they shipped him to St. Petersburg to lead the revolution. I mean, that itself was crazy. And it was done with German money. So the Germans were so stupid as to shoot themselves in the foot by sending this revolutionary that, well, so stupid. He ended the war, but he still was an enemy. And that is already strange. The only money that we know of is the German money, no doubt about this. Mm-hmm. But for something so big, a piece of real estate so big, it's so huge as Russia itself, can we possibly imagine that all the others were not interested in what happened? So we don't know. Apparently, there are no sources. But then you have to look about what the other West, the Allies, did with the Russians. But they were all over the place. And then you have to study that other extraordinary chapter in that history. It's the Russian Civil War. I mean, what was it? 5 years of carnage from one tip to the other. Even the stories in Siberia and all the things that happened over there with Kolchak and the Whites. I mean, it's extraordinary. You could make like a saga of movies like for two decades, I think. It's just an extraordinary material. And then you ask yourself, and I wrote this, I mean, when it came to killing Germans, they found 2 million Americans in a heartbeat. But when the time came to control these abominable Russian communists, there were no allies there. Virtually, you remember that. There were just like little contingents there observing and making sure. We've been told that they were supporting the Whites, who were reactionary and anti-communist. Truth is, they were just there to witness. It looks like one of those UN operations, right? Like Blue Helmet.
Yes.
But you know what I mean? They were just looking to make sure that these guys lost the war, because they really wanted the USSR to emerge there as this bastion. And then if you look at the history of the USSR, and I've written this too, it seems to be moving always in sync and with what the Allies want in controlling and in what was, again, the Mackinder clause in keeping the Eurasian landmass just riven, broken in two pieces. And that's what they did, mm-hmm. despite propaganda and the pronouncements and so on and so forth.
And yeah, the Russian Civil War and sort of the betrayal of the whites, because the white Russians might have, if they had been victorious in the Russian Civil War, very likely would have found common cause with the monarchical Germans, which could have,
yes,
at that point still come back to power.
Yes,
and that's what they're trying to avoid. Yeah.
So, well, of course. Well, of course. Now they say, well, the whites were reactionary. They were pro serfdom. They were anti-Semitic, and so on and so forth. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, very well. But when the time came to seal an alliance with them before World War One, they were okay. But yeah, all of a sudden, yeah. But afterwards, no, they had become distasteful. Well, makes no sense.
Well, yeah, that's.
But yeah, that's.
That type of
exactly they feared, as you said, because they had exactly the same mindset of the German German Junkers, and if those, again, it was another embryo of a Eurasian alliance could have formed, and that was priority number one. That should never ever happen. Mm-hmm.
So the Bolsheviks are victorious in the Russian Civil War, millions dead, country devastated. That serves a lot of interest because Russia is now taken out of the game for a while. I think it's also at this whole point in time, there's a huge asset stripping going along in Russia too, because you have under the cover of the Red Cross, they're going in there and they're taking gold out and resources. I think they're getting mineral rights. That's the Harrimans, and it's the New York and London, City of London doing that.
Yeah, we know that. There's so much we don't know. And I'm telling you, if you raise these issues, because, you know, with books such as mine, you're trying to promote these things amongst dissident or leftist, but there's all the old Marxian guards, which are Lenin worshippers. Mm-hmm. You start telling them that Lenin was somehow helped by the banking elites, and they'll just want they'll want to burn you alive. So these are the themes. There's no mm-hmm. question.
And of course, the research of Anthony Sutton exposed a lot of this, and for his efforts, he was told to he was kicked out of his position at the Hoover Institute because he was exposing too much.
Yes.
Both Hitler
I mean, yeah, we have very little. I mean, those books are important. We all cite them. Mm-hmm. They're beginning, but of a research in that direction. But very little has been done after that. And the other book we have is Quigley's Tragedy and Hope.
Yes.
And that's it. I mean, that's all. I mean, in the conventional historiography, these are the only two sources we have alternative. Mm-hmm. As far as I can reckon, that's it.
So in 1919, Versailles Treaty is signed. The embargo is lifted. The hunger blockade is finally lifted after devastating a generation of Germans, traumatizing them. And you have what you have in the 1920s. You have the Great Inflation, which is sort of fomented by the French invasion of the Ruhr Valley because of the lack of reparation payments. Do you want to get into, say, Versailles Treaty, the 1920s, how this sort of tills the soil for the rise of a reactionary movement in Germany?
No question about that. And the story that the Germans create inflation to pay their way out of the reparation is completely false. That's not at all what happened. This is what you read in the textbooks, I mean. And they didn't. That's not what happened. It was actually triggered by the war loan. And I tell this story in detail. I was melted. And all these things had been perfectly, in my view, predicted by those who the real drafters of the Versailles Treaty. The question is, I mean, and this is not me, then like a giant like Veblen had already seen all this. The question people would ask is that, could one know at this point that out of Versailles, the Nazis would have appeared? And the answer is no, not the Nazis. One would have thought that a new edition of the monarchists would have emerged. Instead, the monarchists, we'll see, will be completely swallowed by the Nazi movement and disappear and merge into that nebula. This is something that Veblen couldn't have foreseen, but he came very close. But the Treaty of Versailles was not, never was an act of chance. It was a very deliberately phenomenal, in its devilish machinations, phenomenal contraption to ignite in time, and they take their time, the second phase of the war.
You have, of course, 1923. Then Schacht is brought in to stabilize the currency.
Yes, yeah. Yes, interesting. Yeah, he's another character, very interesting now, character that emerges.
He's an example of, yes. Schacht. He is, of course, an agent of the Bank of England, right?
Would you say? I don't know what Schacht, I cannot say. He definitely is, he belongs to a different kind, he is definitely a Freemason, and I think it's affiliation to some lodge, which obvious connections to the England ones, which were, and I don't know if they are, but at the time, certainly the most powerful ones, mm-hmm. and brings him into a position, because he frankly appears out of nowhere. We know that in 1922, he was in touch with the Allied command in Berlin, if I'm not mistaken, and then he's brought in as some kind of controller of the currency in order to prepare for this new important, phenomenally important phase of the game in Germany, which is the issuance of a new currency linked to gold that is going to lead to this period of giant investment. If you want some kind of a, well, I'm going to force the terms here, of a giant subprime boom launched in Germany, which had been raised to the ground after, monetarily speaking, after the hyperinflation, by American money transiting through London. And I tell that story, I think, in pretty great detail in the chapter 4 of the book, which is, even by academic admission of some experts who wanted to remain anonymous, unique. There's nothing else in the literature that details that story as it is in my book.
American loans financed the war reparations, which found its way back to France, to France and London.
Yes, and part of the money stayed in Germany to rebuild the industrial infrastructure of Germany. So they rebuild the country already, and they do this all through giant, multinational agreements. So we have Farben, which has licenses to create synthetic oil, and very close connections with American industry. And it's as if it goes in two steps. So we have the Dawes Plan, it's called, which goes from 24 to the beginning of the Great Depression. So we're talking 29, 1930. And that's when the country its infrastructure is renovated with first class equipment from America and all with American money, both. And then the militarization that happens under Hitler. So we're talking, from 35 to the beginning of the war. So yes, so it's been set up. I mean, they set it up, no question. Set it up to send it to war and annihilate it. I mean, this much appears to be clear as you read the chronicle.
German industrial capacities built up in the 20s and early 30s, and then the rug is pulled out with the collapse of the Credit Anstalt Bank.
That precipitates the domino effect. Remains very mysterious to this day. At least I have not been able to find anything. All we know is that this was one of those banks that had been bailed out by the mastermind of this whole story. That was the governor of the Bank of England, is Montague Norman. He was, his fingerprints are on that one as well. So the Credit Anstalt collapses, and this major deflationary crisis strangles Germany for 3 years.
And Montague Norman is an important figure. Of course, he's the head of the Bank of England for almost of a quarter of a century.
Yes, he's extraordinary. Before him, they had 3-year terms.
And so he's sort of like I wouldn't call him the spider to the center of the web. He's an important figure because he has this relationship with Benjamin Strong at the New York Fed, and also with Helmut Schacht. So you have this triumvirate working together to work out this deal. And Helmut Schacht, because his middle name was his father. I'm sorry?
Well, Horace Greeley.
His father admired Americans, apparently. So he's definitely within the Anglo fold, and interestingly enough, he's one of two people acquitted at Nuremberg.
of course.
I think the other one was Franz von Papen. But
yes.
So, okay, so we have
and many others never appeared. So, yeah, of course.
It's interesting because you have this combine or conglomerate, IG Farben, that Schacht facilitates, and this
amongst
is sort
others,
of the is the forge for the Third Reich's arsenal, more or less. This powers the Third Reich's military capability. But if you center on a figure like Montague Norman or Schacht or a company like IG Farben, this sort of this transnational setup, which sort of shows you at the meta level. How the various elites, financial elites within the various countries, America, England, and also Germany, work together to create this war?
Yes, this is a good question, because to a certain extent, you know, they say, well, you have to destroy Germany, but on the other hand, they're working together. I know. Well, it's odd. And when I went to the Bank of England to ask for archival material, there were all the there was this other piece of the puzzle, which is the Bank of International Settlements, which was a bank created in 1930 for the reparations, allegedly a creature of Schacht's mind, which is the now bank, which is in Basel, right?
And it still exists today, yes.
And of course, it still exists. And it started out as something that belonged to this era. And throughout the war, it was presided by an American, McKittrick, I think, from Dillon and Reed. And around the table, they all sat throughout the war, and we have. I mean, we know that there are dossiers dating up to 1944, where the governor of the Reichsbank was there, the governor of the and all the others, and they were just clearing debits and credits amongst them. So there are several tracks in this story. So if we may speculate that a part there was to destroy completely the old Germany and rebuilding it as you preparing the reconstruction as you were destroying the old.
Yes, which I think goes along with explaining the firebombing that occurred in the later stages of the war, because in order to psychologically decapitate Germany, to destroy it, you had to destroy the architecture of old Germany, and that's the devilish nature, I think, of it all. But here we are. Okay, Hitler comes to power in this deal with Hindenburg. He's supposed to be controlled by von Papen. Hindenburg doesn't like Hitler. He rejects him twice. Then the third time, he's finally brought into power. Hitler puts on a polite face, gets into power, and all of a sudden, you've had, of course, most people are familiar with the Reichstag fire, and how it led to the Enabling Act and the forms the basis of Hitler's dictatorship.
There are a lot of gray zones in that story that I myself have not been able to fathom appropriately. Yes, well, Hindenburg rejects him, but then we have those famous 30 days when everything is turned around, and finally in January of 1933, they made him chancellor. And a famous historian, American historian, wrote a book about that. And I don't know. It's strange what happened. Nobody really knows how that happened. But in those, who knows? Maybe threats, counter threats. In a month, everything changes. And it seemed for a moment that before Hitler, there was this general Schleicher, who was vehemently opposed to Hitler. But it's a very strange story. He said he was readying the army to shoot at sight on the Nazis and so on, but nothing happens, and he loses immediately the confidence of Hindenburg, and then he's pretty much set aside, and he will be killed just like an animal during the purge, the Night of the Long Nights in June of 1934. So. I mean, it's extraordinary. And then after that, we have this extraordinary ascent of Hitler, and which begins with the Reichstag fire, which itself has not been really. I don't think Nuremberg ever made clarify what happened there. We all buy into the conspiracy theory that he himself set it up, or that Goering and the SA made this gift to Hitler. Sure, it can be, but we don't. I've read so much about this, but we don't really know. Eventually, of course, no doubt, inside job, as they always are. And by November 1933, he has a publicitary ovation, and he is acclaimed the dictator of the country. And after that, up until 1938, he's going to efface unemployment, which was monstrous. And in 38, he reaches the peak of his Hitler reaches the peak of his stardom.
Yeah, and now it's interesting because after Hitler comes to power, the money pours in to fuel the German recovery. Now some people attribute this to some of German, like Germany was worked out these bilateral trade agreements, and they had repudiated the reparations. And
no, well, yeah, I know, but if you, I've spent so many, and I'm sure as you have, I've spent years and years reading about these the financial agreements of the 30s, and they're completely, I mean, the story is completely incomprehensible, because as you said, for a while, a government after government, starting in 31 with the governments of Luther and others, begging the banks to grant the money to start public works and so on and so forth. And it's a constant refusal. Some of these people go to London because London, of course, was key because that's where the money was transiting from all the world into Germany, begging the British for help, and everybody refuses. And all of a sudden Hitler comes to power, and in a matter of weeks, with shock, Schock goes to the Reichsbank, and immediately after Schock is there, the money appears. And mind you though, they loan money, and I tell this story, they loan money to the, because you think, well, the Nazis, these tyrannous monsters. No, not even to these tyrannous monsters would the bank, you know, they would not give them the money for free. They charge them 6.25% on their first loan. And Hitler just wasn't happy, but he just bit the bullet and went. And nevertheless, they consolidated through a particular scheme of loans that I've described, particular financial mechanisms, and eventually reduced the rate of interest to about 2.8. So still, it was not for free, but they did it. And then, of course, they were just poised with a huge amount of debt. But the question, the project was simple. Now we're going to go to war, and yes, we're going to back all those liabilities with a lot of wealth that we're going to pillage from the rest of them, from what are going to become our satellites.
Yes.
So there.
Yeah, that was war liquidates all debt, doesn't it? Eventually.
Well, yes. Well, of course it does. It does.
And yeah,
but make sure you win it though.
Yeah, that's what happened in World War One. The Germans didn't get their like Franco Prussian War, they could have those indemnities, and they didn't get that after World War One. And also, I think during World War Two, the Nazi occupation, the Germans had a policy of printing script, and that's how they paid for labor and resources throughout their short-lived empire when they occupied Europe.
Yes.
So much with, you know, kind of what the Anglo-Americans do now with the dollar. But
well, that's another long story.
Yes, open up can of worms.
We might discuss that. Well, I have material on that too.
But okay, so here we are. Hitler comes to power. There's a German recovery. Germany is resurgent. In fact, it's even on the cover of Life magazine in the late 30s. And he's even getting good press in many respects. And then this has had this period of appeasement by the part of the British. And you write rather eloquently on this sort of this deceptive game that the British are playing, this sort of dual policy of appeasement and also presentation of sort of presenting to the Germans that there's an element within the British leadership that want to appease that are pro-Nazi. And this is a ruse designed to, I guess, encourage Hitler to embark on war.
It seems that way to me. It's unthinkable. That's unthinkable. There could be pro-Nazis amongst the Brits. They're monolithical. They cluster around their queen bee with devotion. It was the way I see it, and all that extraordinary story of Wally Simpson and Edward. It's extraordinary, and it makes the Nazis look like, despite their truculence, it makes them look like these complete naive imbeciles in the way it appears, but it always remains very very murky what happened there with the story of Rudolf Hess. Yes, they. And I put a map, I recreated a map of the several party formations in my book of all the different, of all these important British politicians that to change camps, and at one point in their lives they are pro-German, then they change again in order to signal and confuse the enemy in this sense. And the story of appeasement, of course, as they tell us, if they do this mea culpa, it's like we tried to appease these Germans who were just exuberant and impossible to deal with, and we made a mistake, and of course, I mean, how can that be? here we are dealing with the état-major of British intelligence. It's the most sophisticated political machine there is. And you're telling me that they didn't know what they were doing? Of course they were. They were just leading this dance with these barbarians who didn't know what they were doing, really, and leading on, and there was just key to them. Just for them, the imperative, the objective number one was just to make sure that this invasion of Russia took place, which was going to lead to their utter destruction, and that's what happened. And so, yes, they created this phantomatic pro-Nazi party that never existed, never.
And the whole thing with Edward VIII, of course, most Americans know that through the movie The King's Speech.
Yes, I didn't see the movie, but yes, that's the story, yes.
Now, you tell an interesting story here. Obviously, you can have an element that's going to play good cop, bad cop with the Germans and get them to manipulate them. But an interesting thing that I wasn't aware of, I hadn't thought about, I knew that the British had wanted to provoke the Battle of Britain and the bombing of London. Mm-hmm. To bomb the cities, to get them away from the RAF airfields, to get them to bomb the cities. Of course, the first really country to bomb cities as a part of strategy were the British against the Germans, the terror bombing, and it was a German response. The Germans never really planned strategic bombing. They didn't have the planes for it. They didn't have the resources for an invasion. And Hitler admired the British Empire. But you tell the story in Lisbon in the summer of 1940 of the British ambassador sort of trying to convince the Germans to bomb London.
Well, it was they did this thing. I mean, it was it was never in earnest. I mean, they were going back. It seemed, if we knew exactly how these factions were signaling to the Germans, we would understand what punctuated this skirmish and the mutual bombings. And another aspect of this war was there was the submarine warfare that we also see in a cinematographic through the movie Das Boot. And the story that what we have left of that of that experience was that there were de facto very few German submarines in the Atlantic. So it's as if he had some kind of a military rear guard there but it was not a real engagement. It was a prosecution of the funny war, as they call it. And there were these things. And at a certain point, as we read history, we know that Germany had also made some progress in the Middle East. And after that, shortly before Barbarossa, which is June 22nd, 1941, when they invade Belarus, all those positions are left. They are cleared, and all the forces are conveyed and channeled towards the east. And at that point, the British skirmish is over. And apparently they reached an agreement in conjunction with that most mysterious episode of Rudolf Hess. Who the hell knows what went down there? But in terms of timing, you know, he disappears officially. What was it? A few days later, the mother of all battles of World War II begins, which is, from the viewpoint of the British and of Mackinder, the greatest, most extraordinary triumph. They have got the Germans and the Russians at each other's throats, and it will be it's going to be a bloodbath. And I don't want to wax lyrical or anything, but I think that was really the end, I think, of Europe. It was over. It was over.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you mentioned the Battle of the Atlantic, and in World War One, the issue of U-boats played a big part in getting America into the war. There's a pretext to sinking the Lusitania, a British ship that was actually part of the British Navy at the time. Nevertheless, it played to the propaganda and enabled Wilson to get Congress to declare war on Germany in April 1917. In the Second World War, you had FDR waging an undeclared war in the Battle of the Atlantic, making similar claims about German submarines attacking German American ships that were false.
Yes.
And that played a big part in the propaganda and getting America into the war. Of course, eventually he had to go pursue the backdoor to war in the Pacific provoke the Japanese into bombing Pearl Harbor in order to get Hitler's declaration of war against the United States a few days later. But the bombing of London also played a big part from a propaganda standpoint, because from an American standpoint, it was this radio broadcast from Edwin R. Murrow, "This is London. London stands alone." And that image of London standing alone and, you know, plucky Britain against this monster Germany, the British Empire. So that sure. played a big part just in psychologically convincing the Americans that this might be the fight. Nevertheless, it took Pearl Harbor to do it.
Sure, sure. There's no question. And even if you read the John Dos Passos for World War One, the U.S. didn't want to be involved in any of this.
Yeah.
They didn't know. They never felt it was the Mackinder thing was... It had to be forced into them. And
yeah.
There's no question.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was always the Eastern Seaboard elite, the people whose opinion mattered in the country, New York, you know, Wall Street.
That's exactly how it is. It's the Anglophiles, and I mean, but this is how this alliance was cemented. There's no question.
And of course, the British, or you mentioned the sort of the British reconquest of the United States culturally. This is all part of
they never left.
Yeah, they never left, and you had Cecil Rhodes and the Union Now, the Pilgrim Society, the Hollywood, you know, the Quarter Circle movies came out pro-British in Hollywood, and you had British actors, and this is still the same today. We still worship the British royalty here in the United States. You know,
it's true.
Why is that?
But if you look even you know, a movie like Captain America, I mean, it's, you know, his girlfriend is a British intelligence officer. And, have you noticed? I mean, it's the same thing. But yes, no. In the 1920s, there was Eugene Debs. There were anti-war movements, and there was a huge popular movement that that has been suppressed completely. And interestingly enough, I was reading in Howard Zinn's book that the young military commanders that led the onslaughts against the civil protesters were the, you know, MacArthur.
Yes, Patton.
Patton. it's a sad story. I mean, there was so much potential there. It's too bad.
Yeah, this was the exposure of the merchants of death, and they're the Nye Committee investigations, and you know, billions of dollars went missing for goods that were never delivered, and mm-hmm. you know, soldiers that made $20 a month, you know, were
right.
You know, while people walked away with hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And ironically, they were then, use those fortunes to promote the next war. That's how it works.
Yes. You know, yes.
But so here we are. So you have this the British through this dual policy of appeasement and also opposing. You have the rise of Churchill. And the focus group, which is very influential, Churchill's indebted heavily.
Churchill he's a character. He's phenomenal. He's everywhere. He is a head of the Navy. Then you find him also in that crazy story of the monetary tricks of the Bank of England. He is head of the Treasury, and then he comes back as the chief commander. I mean.
That's right, because he's the one in the 20s as head of the Treasury that's determined to bring the British pound back on par with the dollar despite the wartime inflation.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was one of the interlocutors of Norman. This elite is very, very tight knit, and you know, the level of devotion is and of commitment is extraordinary. I mean, extraordinary. There's no question about it. You have to recognize that.
And one thing you expose in your book is this apparent, this inexplicable, like, whether naivete or just blindness on the part of Soviet Russia and Stalin on the obvious threat that Germany's posing. And in history books, it's not really explained. It's like, oh well, Stalin trusted Hitler.
but you see
something more important. You see something deeper at work here.
Of course. No, it's an extraordinary story. Yeah, Stalin. Well, I have only found the story in a long encyclopedic history of the German army written by a French minister of the Vichy regime, of all people, and he tells the story, which is extraordinary. It's a story of Marshal Tukhachevsky, right? Mm-hmm. One of the biggest decorated heroes of the Russian army. During the revolution, former nobleman, a blue-blooded aristocrat that converts to the revolution, fights a lot of wars for Trotsky's army and becomes one of the most important young decorated generals. He understands what's happening during the time of appeasement. He sees it coming and he thinks, we are going to absorb the Germans. He said, no way, we have got to stop this now. Right now, 1936 or so, they're incapable of fighting. Let's nip this in the bud and put an end to this charade. He travels with his deputy. He travels to Paris. They tell him to just go to hell. He goes to London, same thing. He comes back. He comes back home. And a year later, he's immediately in prison. A year later, he is executed and follow after with his deputy. And there follow the purges, where allegedly we are told that, I don't know, Stalin decapitates the Russian army. He kills tens of thousands of officers loyal to Tukhachevsky. So, and this story is also extraordinary. And nobody spends any time on the figure of Tukhachevsky. What is happening here? The only way I can explain this is that Stalin is perfectly informed of what is happening, and he is going to sacrifice, he's going to absorb the Nazi shock onto Russian flesh, and he's going to demand a price for this. He will win because the Russians have won the war, and they have. And in fact, at Yalta and at the end of the war, the Allies give him half the world. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. And that sets up the contours of the Cold War. Which absolutely serves everyone's interest, because
that's, well, and then we're on into a new, different production, we're different movie set.
Mm-hmm.
The Cold War has always confused me. I mean, unless you take it at face value, and I don't think you should, then the only way you can understand this is it's a condominium, and it's a theatrical game where we pretend we're going to be enemies, and we're going to manage the world and allowing some abrasiveness at the periphery, if at all. And I'm referring here to Vietnam. You know, what was Vietnam? If not, I think a first engagement, a first feeling of what it would mean to attack China, maybe. But it's a co-management of the world, and most of it theatrical.
Yes.
For me, politics is all show. It's all theatrics. And we see now more than ever. I think we're going to a Cold War 2.0 right now. And it was already, there was appeasement was pure theater. Wally Simpson and Edward, pure theater. And Hitler was also theater. Of course, then there were catastrophes following the theater. But the stage presence of these, and Churchill too, and all of them were great actors. It's some kind of macabre type of cinema, macabre type of theater, because it leads to the death of millions, but it remains theater nonetheless. Cold War, different kind of show, but still a very sophisticated show. And as we all know, terrorism is an act of the Cold War. It began at the end of the 60s. And now we moved on and we've reached our new stages without having understood anything. We don't have conventional good explanation of what terrorism was, you know, the front of the liberation for Palestine and all these extraordinary events of terroristic events of the 1970s all over Europe and the world. But all those techniques that you see now have been tested then and resurrected and changed and so on and so forth. In short, we would have to rewrite everything.
Yeah. Now, of course, you being Italian are probably very familiar with Gladio. And,
I am. I mean, I'm glad.
They do call it theaters of war, like the European theater, the Pacific theater.
You
look at wars as they're productions, but I would say they're the equivalent of mass snuff films. You know.
Oh yeah, yeah. Even better. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's real death and there's real destruction, and of course that death and destruction is a big part of the plan, because it's all part of the asset stripping that war is, and that's whether it's harvesting people's lives or resources. So.
Yes, I completely agree with you. But as you look into it, there is theatrics on the massacre, which makes, when you look deep into these things, I mean, you're staring into madness. This is what I'm trying to convey.
Yeah, yeah. But you put in the book is that why would Stalin do such a thing? Well, Stalin, of course, wasn't Russian. He was Georgian. And he was also, I think you point out in the book, you say, well, because the Bolsheviks, the Soviet state, owed everything to the West.
It appears to be so. I mean, they had nothing, and they passed everything onto them, you know, technology, and even they fed them even during the famine. And although, yes, that's what I think. Although there's a French historian, very aggressive, interesting French historian. She's a woman. She's called, her name is Annie Lacroix, and she denies, she is firmly pro-communist, and she denies that this thing happened. I don't know. I take her very seriously, so I would like to know what she's written about this. But I, so far, until I read what she's written about this, I remain convinced. I don't see. They received a lot of help from the West.
Committed ideologues have a problem seeing that. And ideology, I think, is more as a plaything of the elites. And people who are committed don't want to admit that. They're being used, I guess. But, I mean, if you look at right and left, the magazines, the journals, the TV shows, the movements, they always have some sort of elite funding. It's all part of a dialectic that's being played out.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no. They decide. They create the factions, and then they ask you to take sides. But it's all choreographed, of course.
Yeah. You know. So that's what you do if you're an oligarch. If you want to manage the world, and if you're going to manage the world, you're going to have to engage in some very complex three-dimensional chess that isn't really explained to the common man, even at the university level. Even at the universal level, we're given this very, I think, a comic book, a fairy tale view of history of good versus evil and nation states as two-dimensional nation states, and political leaders are the epitome of power, they're the top of the power. We're not ever shown, you know, the gray eminence or the real power behind a throne, which is always financial, you know.
Well, no, I agree with you. I mean, yes. I mean, it's what Frank Zappa said. You know, schools are just made to create ignorance with class. I mean, that's it. That's true. It's true. I mean, all of it. You know, the record, the historical record is falsified, and not to mention the humanities. And I'm not going to talk for the hard sciences, but the humanities and social sciences is a disgrace. The way I see it as a political economist is that for me financial power is an auxiliary. It's crucial, and nowadays in the modern hypermodern era, fundamental if not primary auxiliary. But I think that the direction of the game, for me at least, is still in the hands of political strategists. I don't think that bankers and financiers have the vision for the ultimate vision for the management of power, although they understand their sectors perfectly, and they are it's and these things have been explained in the old political school of the Germans pre-World War I. There was this famous scholarship that said that corporations were born. The joint stock idea were originated with the Venetians when they were accompanying the Crusaders, and I think that's exactly how it is. The Crusade is set in motion, and around it forms this galaxy of financial economic interests, very well organized, very supple, that accompanies this movement for conquest, this wedge for power, which is directed by, for me, strategists. Real political minds.
Now, in the war itself, you talk about this financial combine. We mentioned IG Farben, but throughout the war, you have these complex relationships that persevere, that exist throughout the war between Standard Oil, Union Banking. That's you tied with the Bushes, you know, Prescott Bush, and that was exposed somewhat.
That came out in a U.S. Senate investigation, right? 1942. I mean, it's not what you say. People say it's conspiracy theory. Well, no, it isn't.
Yeah,
it's an act of the U.S. government.
Yeah, and I think Prescott Bush went off and founded the USO as a PR move, and they stopped talking about it. But that's the basis of his fortune was his ties to the Fritz Thyssen Steel combine, I think, or dynasty. But what I'm getting at is that throughout the war, I mean, a good example, I think you had these continuing arrangements where Standard Oil facilitated the acquisition on part of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, of this crucial tetraethyl, the aviation fuel. You have them working with IG Farben producing, the patents played a big part in them, producing synthetic oil. That was a big part of their war effort. Of course, the role of IBM. I mean, yes. Auschwitz-Birkenau, first and foremost, was a huge industrial concern that, that IBM was involved with. AT&T, So these banking interests, the Rothschild Bank was never raided in France by the Nazis. So you have all the, I think these, I get, at a meta level, you have all these financial, corporate, transnational relationships that don't seem to be sundered by the war.
What I remember was that also the plants, the Ford, yes. Ford and GM plants were not firebombed either. And there's also literature. I guess there's an author who specializes in this, and where the idea was that there's these few rotten apples who have done business with the Nazis. And I guess it's part of this economically deterministic view that it's just people are out there to make money, eventually lead to these disastrous arrangements. But we all know that we all own the contracts at those levels, industrial contracts at those levels do not happen without government approval. Mm-hmm. And we go back to the question we were before, who's in charge? It's the political power. And these economic potentates do not have the autonomy to act alone.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, into the war, you mentioned the Operation Barbarossa. This is this fateful decision by Hitler to invade Russia. Mm-hmm. Initially successful, it drives very deep into Russia and comes very close. I mean, getting to Moscow.
Of course, yes.
There's Stalingrad, his drive south because of oil, economic interest. This blunts, the offensive towards Moscow.
Yes.
A blunder, perhaps. But, of course, this event inevitably closes out this phase. You kind of close it out around 1943, and that's kind of when the fortunes of war decisively turn against Germany, because you have Stalingrad, Kursk, and that, after all, it's all downhill. This eclipse of German power and, let's say, the beginnings of the Cold War. I want to get into that a little. I know that's not a big part of your book, but it helps explain why this story that you write about in Conjuring Hitler is still so relevant today.
Yeah, well, it's... To be honest with you, we all read these books, and there are various opinions about everything. Military historians will tell you that it was one battle that decided everything. Others deny it. And the fall of France, for instance, which I don't deal with in my book, which is very strange, right? In 6 weeks, they disappear. And they don't lift a finger for the rest of the war. Very strange. Mm-hmm. So we have all this big military historians that tell us, well, yes, they made the Germans made this very successful advance. The French were unprepared and this and that. And I just don't buy it. There must have been something else in the elite behind this. The country doesn't just disappear, not France, at least. Likewise, in the military history of the campaign of Russia, there's a monumental literature about this. And I obviously have not covered it all. I've read many things. We read that the war was lost in 43. I have even read reports that the Vatican was informed that the Germans had completely lost the war in 1941 by failing to secure God knows what strategic advantages. Now, we're getting into the very deep mechanics of these things, and I don't know. But for some reason... from the Vatican's viewpoint, the war is even finished even sooner than 1943. What happened there? Who knows? And it seems strange that the Germans, for all their military prowess, could have completely miscalculated and made the mistake that Napoleon did, and even on a grander scale. It's so full of great mysteries. Yes, and after that, the game changes entirely. Germany is absorbed and begins this other production that we were discussing a few seconds ago, whose abiding manifesto, whose abiding revealing document is, of course, George Orwell's 1984. And it might have been cited a million times. There's nothing original in mentioning that novel, but those few pages of the secret book in 1984 where Orwell explains how the game is to be played, for me, still stand for then and today, right? This ongoing war against, Oceania and so on and so forth. It seems like, now North Korea, it's the same game.
Yeah, it's the endless war It's you know, we forget a good, well, the World War II is a good example of that, because almost on a dime, Soviet Russia turns into the villain when it was proclaimed a hero during the war in the American press. Stalin. You have movies like Mission to Moscow about, you know, by Davies, Joseph Davies, the ambassador there. The North Star. All these movies that, you know, they, Stalin is actually there to defend freedom and democracy of all things. And then all of a sudden, the Cold War kicks in 1946-47, and they're the villain. And that's Orwellian. Very Orwellian.
It is. And still now Putin and but the feeling I have is that it's a grand charade. It's just a grand theater. They're all playing. You know, it's not that there is. It's not even that they're inventing the enemy. It's like there's a script and everybody is playing. And I think that a lot of people like playing the villain. And I'm thinking also, of course, of this Islamic terror. And and let's face it. I mean, for actors, playing the villain is sometimes very exciting, no?
And of course, the supposed today's terrorist threat grows out of the Cold War, because you have the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
Yes.
And of course, I alluded to Gladio and what was going on in Europe, and sort of the terrorism, the days of lead and in Europe, which now has been exposed as a NATO operation. These stay-behinds, they were perpetrating false flag terrorist attacks to change the political environment. And of course, raises all types of questions, what goes on everywhere in terms of terrorism, whether it's here in the United States or somewhere else. Is it being fomented to create a strategy of tension, as Vincenzo Vinaguerra testified to. You know.
Yes. Well, I've written a long piece about the strategy of tension. Of course, this was a big thing, because in Europe we had 10 years of terrorism. So when we hear about terrorism, I mean, we know. And what we know is, and many mysteries have not been revealed, but we're cynical enough to know that virtually the political bureaus of the police can create terrorists out of anything they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or just
A while, I bought myself into Gladio a lot, but frankly, after I looked at the Italian case, well, no question. I mean, Italy is is a U.S. colony, so of course the U.S. is present all over the place. But there was very much in Italy, I mean, I'll say this briefly because it doesn't belong to this conversation. Yeah. It was very much an attack on a certain political establishment, which had also very strong U.S. backing, but U.S. backing began to be divided. And these were the Christian Democrats, and they came under attack, and they were very much in charge, you know, in the Vatican II of the country. And in order to do this, immediately out of nothing, all these political and terrorist formations appear, mushrooming out of nowhere for 10 years, and will just they will be go on a rampage, and we've seen this, and we saw how artificial all of it was, even though some of it was rooted in discontent and in political movements. But we know that there are some bureaus in the ministries and in the apparatus that have maneuvered these groups. And we've been told and given an idea of how these things are done. So, you know, terrorism, and they say, well, it's the weapon of the weak. It's the exact opposite. It's a military army in the hands of power. For a different type of game.
Yeah, and with Gladio, we see, of course, the role of these strange Freemasonic organizations like Propaganda Due, and the various people belong to it, because that, if you look at the people belong to it, like Silvio Berlusconi, the police ministers, so it's sort of a state within a state. So there, it's sort of a practical way that one achieves these things, by suborning and undermining the state by creating a state within a state. These networks of criminal networks, you know.
Well, you know, there's always, Well, there are always factions, and the factions, it depends. When a certain faction decides to attack another, that's when these things happen. And you have, generally, when you have these movements, you are in a civil war, context. And generally, they also use terrorist groups to do this, which are created by targeting a certain kind of psychological profile of people who are in the movements and so on. So in terms of Gladio and so on and so forth, I don't know. I certainly know how this was. I appreciated and I studied how this was done very much as a turf war amongst factions who battle for control of the establishment in that case was in Italy, but they do it all over. It can happen anywhere, depending on where that is. And you're bound to see these things emerge. But they are, let's call them techniques of power, this creation and management of terrorist organizations.
Yeah. And, of course, the Cold War itself can be, I think can be fairly described as a strategy of tension writ large.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Going back to the Second World War, of course, we have this right after the end of the war, because we have the strange dealings with Alan Dulles in Switzerland, with SS General Wolf negotiating this the rat line and these things. The stories what's his name? You know, the Hitler's...
You're talking about Paperclip and all that?
Paperclip and also the Nazi, you know, the Bormann, the Bormann capital flight. That was set up in July 44 after Stalingrad. And, well, what I'm getting at is here we have, when you talk about factions, and you can see some of these, whether it's false flag terrorism, these fomented wars, or what's going on, is often we tend to look at the elite as monolithic, and we shouldn't do that because no grouping of people are monolithic. Right after the Second World War, we might get a glimpse of this. I want to see if you agree with this analysis, because we had the exposure of the Rosenbergs, Alger Hiss, right in the late 40s, and I've kind of look at this as one faction going after another faction of elite, because roughly in the United States you had a, for lack of the better word, after the war, a pro-German, pro-Nazi Dulles faction, fascist faction, going against the Morgenthau, more leftist communist faction, and you could see it played out with the exposure of Alger Hiss, because it was decided by Dulles that West Germany was needed as a bulwark against the East, the Warsaw Pact. So they needed to be built up, and Morgenthau's plan was scrapped. And we kind of see it, and that kind of forms the contours of the Cold War. Is that a defensible analysis, do you think?
Yeah, no doubt. I agree. I mean, sometimes it's monolithic, sometimes it isn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, for briefly, in Italy in the 1970s, the Catholics, for good or ill, came under attack, and the communists tried to seize power, so there was civil war. Mm-hmm. In a sense, low intensity civil war, they call. So at that point, they were no longer friends. In the case of the United States, yes. So you mentioned Alger Hiss, and Harry Dexter White, and all that. Mm-hmm. And they pretty much sacrificed all these people who had been the ones who had been in touch with the Russians at the time when they were needing to finish the war, where they were out. And yes, I've read a lot about Alger Hiss, a lot, as much as I could, still could not understand what happened there. And very critical, crucial, because also in those events, you understand what it, there's no question that a faction was being liquidated, no question. Mm-hmm. And I think to this faction belonged also people like very interesting American politicians like Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture, who had different ideas. And I think I heard that he is a key figure in Oliver Stone's documentaries about the hidden face of history, mm-hmm. which I haven't seen, but I think he's featured prominently in that one. And that group, there's a group which is eliminated, no doubt. What was happening, I do not know, but I know these are essential aspects for understanding the further development of the Cold War, also because they feature other figures of which I, the most important of whom I think is one of the most important is Richard Nixon, and Nixon was one of the inquisitors with the Committee on Un-American Activities in in eliminating this faction. So that would tell us exactly what was happening. As to Germany being now recuperated and given a second virginity as a bulwark against Russia, I don't know. At that point, Germany was just, I think it was just defanged and absorbed. And I think the game was different. And I've had discussions and with German journalists and others asking me what I thought of Paperclip. I don't know. I feel that when the war is over at that point, whatever happens to these other Nazis that are recycling the U.S., I always personally, but I may be wrong, I always found that part of history less interesting, because at that point they are just they are a breed that's completely defeated and politically insignificant at that point. So I don't know if they were that important in through the pro-Nazi channels. I'm not even sure that Dulles was all that pro-Nazi. I think he was just like Norman. He was a very skilled manipulator and person who was just making things done, appearing to be friends with people that he ultimately despised for the purposes of furthering the agenda of the power he worked for. Maybe.
Of course, the Dulles brothers were both at Versailles, correct?
They were, yeah. They were young lawyers working for that firm, that critical firm in New York, Sullivan, Cromwell, whatever. Yeah.
Which represents all the corporations through which the CIA actually works for.
No. Dulles is an absolutely essential figure, and close to the Jesuits. His son was a Jesuit. Mm-hmm. Also, that connection with the Vatican. As we read through these biographies, fascinating. You know, I always exclaim, you know, if we only knew, you know, what really went down with these people. Well, we can only.
And the Cold War is critical in getting the Vatican on board the Cold War agenda, because putting the fear of godless communism into the Vatican played a big part in suborning the Vatican, I think, part of the CIA.
Absolutely. Yeah. I told that story in a piece that written by a book by Sean Stone, Oliver's son. And I go into great lengths about what the Vatican did, its position between the two wars, and it's incredible. Mm-hmm. And we know very little, and most of what has happened is, again, I found in this the historiographic digging of this French historian I was mentioning before in a book about the Vatican and Nazism, which I found fantastic. And and actually it seems that the church had bet on two horses. One was the Germans, oddly enough, because it thought that the Germans, through their invasion of Germany, were going to win. And they thought that, allegedly, according to the secret protocols of the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, that the church, the evangelizers of the church were going to follow the German troops in re-Christianizing the USSR, which is like
really? The next,
yes, it's written in that book. And if our evidence is good, this is something that Pius XII, you know, he's a taboo argument. We know that after his death, the nun that lived with him as his companion, basically his confidant, apparently the legend has it that she has burned mounds of private correspondence. So big mysteries are there. Mm-hmm. At any event, there seems to be no doubt, and this jives with some of the things that I've researched for Conjuring Hitler, that, you know, and we know that the Catholic Church supported Hitler, no question. They certainly didn't allow Schleicher, the general, the so-called Red General, of staying in power, and Pacelli, who was then the nuncio, he was the ambassador of the Vatican in Germany, and then became Secretary of State before becoming Pope, definitely supported the old aristocracy, the von Papens, who were all Catholics, who supported Hitler in turn, and swayed the Catholic vote for Hitler. So they were supporting, and this is why they're getting a lot of fire from the ultra-patriotic French. So there's a giant debate of those days. And so I think that they were planning on re-Christianizing the USSR, which was their giant nemesis, but crafty and careful negotiators that they are, because they understand politics very well, they also very much kept a foot in the American camp. And so they had very close contacts with all of that other galaxy, the Dulles and more, and the Knights of Columbus. And there was, I mean, that all the U.S. Catholic world through people like that famous cardinal, what was his name? Well, very famous, the Archbishop of New York. Well, it will come to me. And this is what I was saying. They were informed, and they are very well informed, that the Germans had failed. And at that point, they extricated themselves their commitment with the Germans and threw themselves completely in the arms of the Americans and sealed ever since a very close entente. And you could follow the history of the church, which is very complex, and there's very little, very obscure and impenetrable, but the presence of the U.S. in the church is very strong.
Mm-hmm. One other thing. How much time do we have?
as much as you want.
I'm not taxing you too much.
No, not at all.
Okay, good. Just want to make sure. Another element, of course, through the First and Second World War, because a critical element in bringing America into the Second World War, I mean the First World War and the Second World War, was was Zionism. Of course, the Balfour Declaration was backed up with a promise of using Jewish influence in the United States within the Wilson administration to get the country into the First World War. Of course, agitation in the Second World War was key too. The whole thing with Charles Lindbergh and these things.
The
American First Committee and all that. Of course, the fulfillment of the Zionist vision was greatly, I think, wouldn't have been possible without the catastrophe of the Second World War. So you have the sort of this coming out of Zionist power, Jewish power here in the United States. Of course, up until the 60s, I think you still had the WASP elite running things, and then you had the sort of this, by this late 60s and 70s, you have coming of age of Zionist power, of Jewish power here in the United States, and the neoconservatives. Mm-hmm. Because the neoconservatives play a big part in U.S. foreign policy after the 1970s.
Yes.
Do you have anything to say on that?
Yeah, sure. Ever since the book came out, I guess a lot of people, a number of people just say, well, what you're really saying is that when you mean bankers, you mean Jews and Masons, right? And I say, no, absolutely not. I don't see it that way at all.
It was Cardinal Spellman.
Spellman, excellent. Exactly.
There you go. Sorry, I was thinking about that name in the back. What's that name? It's Cardinal Spellman of New York. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. So no, I don't believe much in this the 300 rabbis that decide the fate of the world, as Rathenau once said, he himself a Jew. And for me, it's not that. In the end, the Mackinder context explains everything already. So that's the thing. And the creation of Israel, as you said, the Balfour Declaration was it. And it is itself a product of the Mackinder program. The idea was to create faults, as they call them in the jargon, areas that where there must be a constant earthquake, perennially seismic, and one is of course Poland, because that's what stands between Russia and Germany, and there are various all over the place around, because the landmass is enormous, and in the southern periphery of the western part of the landmass there is Israel, and so they created this thing. And they populated it with very ardent nationalists, as the British strategists themselves have described. And it's been like that, a center of agitation. And then the whole thing just colored itself with a variety of racial, political undertones. But we all know that is just, you know, like it's a superimposed thing that has nothing to do with creed or anything. Mm-hmm. It's a play of fanaticisms that have been somehow grafted onto just another thorn that has been planted in the Arab world to create a state of perennial destabilization. And that's what they have to do. Of course, they were expecting that this place to become a peaceful haven of God knows what, but that was never the plan. It was meant to be a country of perennial war. And in fact, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And that's it. I don't believe that the Zionist lobby is what influences American politics. Even a Zionist like Noam Chomsky himself said repeatedly that if the United States stopped funding Israel, Israel would disappear in 2 seconds. So,
it's almost a question of some people refer to it as the Anglo-American Zio Empire, and I don't know. I mean, who's the junior partner in that relationship? It's a genuine question. I don't know the answer to. I think at times, like anything, I think power waxes and wanes depending on the circumstances.
I don't know. I'm not an expert on Israeli politics by any stretch. I mean, I was in Israel when I did my tour in the Middle East about 10 years ago. No, I mean, it's as we said in the beginning, I mean, what we're observing right now is just a continuation of the British Empire and everything that, and the United States are doing it for them, you know, with their brawn and their resources. And this is why there's a lot of good movements in the United States that are saying, you know, enough of this, and enough of this, especially in the name of peace.
Yeah. And I think your point about fomenting fanaticism is key on both ends, because if you really look at the Middle East, you have this, you have NATO, America, and also Israel fomenting Islamic fanaticism.
Sure. But I mean, we all know that before. I mean, this Islamist thing is a very, very recent thing. They say, I mean, that it started very slowly after the final war, the one in 73 of the Yom Kippur, after which Arab nationalism was on its knees. And so they had to come up with something else. And so they went back to this Islamic pride and the veil and all that. But before then, there was nothing of this in the Arab world. It was a very secularized, it could have been a fantastic place. Beirut was the symbol of what the Middle East could have been had we had peace, regardless. And it's a recent invention. And it's a recent invention whose grand rehearsal, and this is something about which nobody speaks, was tested by the French in Algeria. And that is when they started creating, again, speaking of these terrorist groups, artificially incubated the GIA, the Islamist groupings. Those were, and there's a fantastic book, which I don't think has been translated in English. I would like to do that at some point, by a former Algerian intelligence agent that just recounts the story of how they created these things to wage the battle for political power in Algeria. And that story was extraordinarily violent. Horrible things have happened, but nobody discusses it. And that has been the very first act of this Islamic story, which nobody knows really, but that's important.
Now, bring it up to probably how to close this interview out is bring up to contemporary times is the Mackinder Doctrine, I think, is still in play, of course. And we have this attempt to recreate the Cold War with the Russians, with this sort of demonizing of Putin. I think it was William Engdahl has written much about this, about trying to prevent this Anglo-American strategizing to prevent it, the formation of a Eurasian alliance. He seems to think that there might be an Eurasian alliance being formed anyway because of NATO aggression. What's going on today vis-a-vis Russia and China and this what we're seeing, the possibility of this formation of a Eurasian alliance? Because if you look at China itself, Russia and China are also very infiltrated with Anglophiles. So what's the possibility of this occurring? What's your take on that?
I know. Yeah, it's a good question. We all wonder what it is. It's so very strange, because in a way we very much could have peace, because what the Eurasian Commonwealth could do was just to come and just say, you know, let's just, and what they're doing, you know, the Silk Road and the Grand Trans-Eurasian Highway, and just say to the United States, come, be a partner of it, and let's just get rich. And that would be the end of it, you know? But no, there seems to be a clause against it. And so my feeling is that it's understood, and Putin has said this in these strange, interesting interviews that have appeared, the Megyn Kelly and the Oliver Stone interviews that have been aired, and saying presidents come and go, the policy is always the same. And that's what he means. And he also makes these little jibes saying, they don't consider me a European leader. So it's just a way of saying, you know, you will never, you know, this is the game. And if you want to be the macho Putin, you will have to do just what you're doing and never think of coming to Europe. And I think he's okay with it. And so they're all playing this, again, this theatrical play. And I think they're just getting ready to, as I said, they're just preparing another re-edition. They're studying another re-edition of the Cold War, where now North Korea is going to have a bigger role, allegedly. Interesting place, North Korea, and a lot to say about that. And I don't think well, there's the Shanghai organization, but I don't think they will break through the barrier and open to Europe. Now Europe has been completely crystallized around this new NATO understanding, and they're keeping it this way so far. And so the divisions continue. So I think that overall, the British veto remains. But there are changes ahead. Something's going to happen. Also economically, you know, we've had 10 years of stagnation after the Lehman Brothers fall collapse. Something is going to happen. They are reengineering the game here, but I don't foresee that they're going to revolutionize what's going to happen. I think Putin is comfortable playing the new Stalin in a way, but you know, kind of a posher, more amiable, more glossier Stalin, you know.
Stalin with a human face, right?
Yeah, yeah, you know, macho. Yeah. You know, he's cool. He does judo. Yeah. You know, yeah. he's appealing, and that's what these interviews are trying to convey. And I don't know. What's your impression? How do you feel from how do you look upon all these this flow of information?
Well, it's hard to really assess it because sometimes I feel like we're all being played. I don't think it's like, yeah, it's New World Order. They're all in control. It's all a game. I do think there's some genuine opposition on the part of Russia, what Russia represents as a people, a culture, a history. Not so much Putin, because a lot of people get stuck on the personality. It's the powers of Putin is representing. It's complex. I talked to a few Russians. They can't stand Putin because he's corrupt. And but then again, some think, well, he's standing up for Russia. He's this resurgence of orthodoxy, which I think is a healthy rebalancing of things, because what's happened, the West, I think, is in a high advanced state of corruption. Maybe it's Freemasonic. I'm a Catholic, and the Catholic Church is very troubled right now, I think, as an institution, whether it can rebound and fulfill its mission as a, you know, but,
go on. I'll tell you something later.
Yeah. So it's one of these things hard to figure out. I'm a little intimidated by all, but saying I can figure it all out. I do think from a health, it's good that we're getting some pushback, and maybe it will promote a sane, more balanced policy on the part of NATO and the West. Because I do think this lack of a check since the end of the Cold War has been a corrupting influence. That's obvious by NATO's lunge eastward in the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And so to the extent that Putin can provide a check, a counterbalance, and encourage some sobriety on the part of the West, we might edge closer to a world that's a bit more peaceful and a bit more prosperous. And maybe that's all I can really realistically hope for in this fallen world, you know. So
I appreciate what you're saying. And then, because you mentioned that I am at the University of Washington. I have left the University of Washington a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
The last 5 years, I've been at the Pontifical Gregorian University. Working.
Yeah, I was reading from your book. Yes.
Yeah. No. This is not to correct you, but this is going back. You know, I've seen the Vatican from within. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, you know, if you said you're Catholic, and, you know, from one Catholic to another, it doesn't look good.
Yeah.
It doesn't look good at all. It's actually revolting. And I will say no more now, but we can have that conversation.
Yeah.
The time. And another thing, me too. I have the same desires you do. I want to see peace. I want to see people have fun. I want to see our surplus being spent in actual real theaters and art and hospitals and not bombs. And we are understood on this. But then again, we hope that, for instance, other powers could just come in as a sobering effect, as you say. But then again, let's just think about this. The state of New York in America alone produces as much wealth as Russia as a whole. So, you know, and so what could Russia possibly do?
Yeah.
So in the end, the levers are in other hands.
Yeah. But hopefully its vastness can check it. Yeah, that's always been the case, right? Its vastness has checked other
people. Yeah, I know some friends of mine. You know, likewise, like they tell me what yours have told you, and they tell me that, you know, St. Petersburg and Moscow are very high tech, but the parts, the vastness, the parts of the country that are in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
So it's are we really talking? You know,
upper volta with nuclear weapons, as they used to say.
Yeah. It's. Yeah. I don't know. You're right. We need to hope, and let's hope something changes and not get too, you know, just too calcified in pessimism. But
I think that's the point, because if you look at it, this Europe's technology Russia's resources and China's factories. The odd man out are the Anglo-American Empire, because there's no need for the dollar, and that's what they're trying to break up. This whole idea of the silk, you know, you want the sea power wants to make again goes back to Mackinder as the sea power disrupting this Eurasian alliance of trade that the sea power that Leviathan can't disrupt when it wants to stranglehold.
I know. I wish it were so simple, because on the other hand, the Anglo-American tandem is a tandem full of vitality, though.
Yeah.
They have so much energy, and I just spent 6 months in Taiwan, and I can tell you that, and I've toured the world, and everybody wants to be American, and I've seen British flags everywhere, and doormats, baby prams, apparel. There's a mystique, and the U.S. is a place of great creativity and great dynamism. And as many say, you know, the peace will have to come from America, probably because the obstacles to peace and because there's so much weaponry and a cult to war. But but because Americans live amongst that, those who want peace will be the strongest forces, and those who will know best what to face and how best to overcome it. And through them will probably come the solution. And I think this is... This is possible, and I really hope so.
I think it comes from a lust to dominate, which is Luciferian.
I'm sorry?
A lust to dominate, which is Luciferian and demonic in its final analysis.
Sure.
If you doubt that, just Henry Kissinger, this American statesman, in 1974, wrote in National Security Study Memorandum 200. That
Kissinger? The world famous Kissinger, right?
Yeah, he called for increasing the death rate in the third world by 20%, that would free up resources for the then the existing American corporations. Because you say American, they're really transnationalists. They have no, you know, they don't.
I know. But you know, it goes deeper than that. It's the mindset. It's a mindset that it's nothing to do with one country or another. It's more of a predatory mindset, which is prevalent all over the world, more or less in certain parts, and less, more in others, less in others. But it's that we have to defeat. You know, the predatory mindset is a general cult of violence in one form or another. It doesn't have to be brutality. Any form of just bullying the others and of wanting to, you know, of exploiting others one form or another is the problem, and that's what we have to defeat as a race, I think, and we'll have to go through that.
Well, yeah, Perfidious Albion, they've always been very good at carrying out various subtle forms of coercion that people aren't even aware of.
Well, yeah, we can put it that way. Yeah. I mean, in this general barbarous mindset in which most of the race acquiesces. Yeah, certain powers historically have developed more sophisticated ways of achieving their ends. And let's face it, a lot of people are really proud of belonging to that group. Yeah, I know that. We, you know, when they go through these wars, you know, they wax very emotional and they start saying, we here, we there, you know, and we did this, we did that, when it was their ancestors or maybe people that have nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
We have to lose this fascination with violence.
Yeah.
Completely.
Now, to close it out, there's an ending of your book, I think, which sums up your argument in the book very well. If you don't mind, I'll read it.
Go ahead.
This stratagem of identifying a native force, which can then be directed in a variety of extremely creative ways, either to foment divisions at home or to be spun against a neighbor, is a mere routine. World War I, the conjuration of Hitlerism, World War II are possibly the most spectacular and horrifying examples in our recent historical record of what such imperial routines are capable of engendering. These also reveal that, in general, the true source of evil resides not so much in the actual or often unspeakable villainy of resurrected cults, but rather in the aseptic, cool, and calculating imperial mindset of the modern English-speaking oligarchies, which remorselessly and with an inhuman dose of self-righteousness managed to manipulate all forms of life-destroying manifestations and turn them to account for the purpose of world control, i.e. power. Excellent.
Yeah, well, I wrote this at the time. I remember this, the war in Iraq had just begun, and I was just furious. And it's not that I want to write against the British. Of course, I have no quarrel with it. It's that... But the British and a certain kind of elite, they always hearken to, and they always invoke the name of the defeat of Hitler in order to wage more wars. I mean, it's just like it's propagandistic capital that seems to give them the right to continue to wage wars, because they said, well, once we defeated the Antichrist, and that gives us the right to continue to kill. And I just said to myself, I would like to see an end to this, and maybe it would be good if we start taking down these, debunking these stories one by one, and so that we can have peace at last.
Exactly. That's why if you were opposing the Iraq War in 2003 or the Gulf War in 1991, often you heard the accusation that you were forgetting the lessons of Munich.
Yeah, of course. Okay. Yeah. It never ends. And yeah. They're always conjuring that name, always. Mm-hmm. And you know, every time they do it, it's just, you know, it's in bad faith to put them out. And a lot of us just had had enough of this. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, Hitler, you want to? Okay, I'll tell you the story to the best of my knowledge. And it's not what they told you.
No, I tell people that the real history is far more interesting. If you want to delve into it, just it will take a lot more time. It's far more confusing than the little simplistic moralistic fairy tale we've been given. So I encourage everybody to go out and purchase a copy of Conjuring Hitler, How Britain and America Made the Third Reich by Guido Giacomo Preparato, right? Giacomo Preparato.
Giacomo.
Guido Giacomo Preparato. Okay, great. And of course, your website, you have a website, correct?
Yes. And I encourage everyone to visit it. And there's plenty of materials there.
So. And that's GuidoPreparato.com. You have essays, blog, your books are there, essays you can get. And so go there, read it, read his material. It's great stuff. I want to thank you for spending so much time with me.
My pleasure.
It's been a great talk. And I'll wish you a very pleasant summer in your travels.
Same to you.
And maybe we'll talk again in the near future.
We'll keep in touch. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.